To the Mel Kay Show. My guest today is an incredible reporter, a journalist, somebody who's been out there on the front lines telling the truth no matter what comes. He has been somebody also that has been in the crosshairs of a very, very, I don't know what to say about the intelligence agencies and what's happening now, but it is certainly un-American, and he is breaking news every day. I'm really honored to welcome Steve Baker to the show. Thank you for joining me, sir.
Mel, thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. I've been following you for quite some time. And recently, you changed the narrative in a narrative that we have seen very manipulated of January 6th for a very long time. But before we get into that, I want you to tell my audience a little bit about you and your background.
Well, my background actually is in 40 years in the music business and doing this on the side for probably about 25, 30 years of that, mostly doing political commentary and analysis as a more or less a hobbyist. Back when the internet first started, when there was Prodigy and CompuServe and AOL, and then that became MySpace. MySpace became Facebook. Right. Facebook became a blog, and here we are. But when COVID came to town, that changed everything for me because I was actually earning my living in the music live performance side of the music business. And the government took my job away from me. I mean, literally said, you can't work. And so I thought, okay, well, then I'm going to go after you.
Right. I was on the other side. I was working on a set in New York and we were shut down on the 15th. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do now. I might as well start getting upset out there. Actually, for me, it was really I saw Cuomo come on TV with Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt and announced that they were reimagining New York during the 2 weeks to stop the spread. And I said, oh, this is not about a virus. And I started this. But I have to say, I have watched you through the periods of time over that you're talking about. And it's turned out that the people that were the commentators living full lives ended up being now the voices that are the most important. If you were stuck in the world of climbing the rungs in journalism, it appears that you are not really a journalist anymore. And you are. So you started reporting on January 6th from January 6th. So let's talk a little bit about how that came to pass, because you're one of the people out there, I believe, that has been the most honest and also the most steadfast in staying on top of the stories as they unfold. So let's talk a little bit about when and how you got involved in that world.
Yeah, I was actually out touring the country during the lockdowns. I traveled to 28 states while the nation was locked down, mostly doing interviews and meeting with groups, speaking at gatherings. Some of them were illicit gatherings, and we would form our own little speakeasies, that sort of thing, and various, depending upon what the situation was in the city or the state that I was in. Yeah. But I was gathering information at the time because I was working on a book about COVID, specifically about the political ramifications, that sort of thing. And when January 6th was announced by Trump on December 19th of 2020, I put it on my travel schedule. It was no more complicated than that. Right. I to be perfectly honest with your audience, I've never been a Trump guy. I was one of those guys in 2016 that voted third party. And I was not a Hillary person either. Let's get that out on the table.
Right.
But I probably had him by the time he had finished his first term in office at about a 50-50 rating on my liberty scale. Yeah. And I was certainly interested in what was happening with the election. I wasn't convinced that it was a stolen election, but I am aware enough to know anomalies when I see them. I'm pretty good at math. I'm pretty good at the numbers. And I knew something was up. So from my perspective, I wanted to go to January 6th specifically to hear what was going to be said from the stage, because if they were going to unleash the Kraken, as they used to say, that was the day that I anticipated it would happen. I mean, of all places, at the last minute, that's where you needed to do it. So I showed up at the event with my bag full of tricks. I had my man on the street microphone and a tripod and the camera, and I was ready to interview people about what was said from the stage that day. And to be perfectly honest with you, it was largely a nothing burger. And I know that people had a great time, those who didn't get involved in any of the bad stuff, but people were really excited and energized. It was a great spirit out there with thousands and thousands of flags waving amongst this sea of people. And so I captured that on video. And then I was there actually with another writer. And in fact, the guy that I was working on the book with, and we decided to, because it was cold, and we decided to start heading over to the Capitol early because there were scheduled events there. Yeah. And there were publicized and scheduled events that were to take place. And so we wanted to beat the crowd because it was a crowd. Right. And so we, about halfway through Trump's speech, we started working our way over. And of course, by the time we got to the Capitol, when I reached the reflection pool on the west side of the Capitol, I could see smoke. I could hear flashbangs. Wow. There were sirens coming up as Metropolitan Police were reinforcing the Capitol Police at that time. We had no idea what was going on, except right. that I looked at my colleague and I said, that's where we're going. Yeah. And we broke out in a run and we headed up there. I turned on my camera at exactly 1:19 p.m. on the west battle line. And that's what I did for the next hour was capture the fighting that was taking place on that West Terrace. And then, of course, the story itself went inside the building, and I eventually did as well. And that action alone has put me in the crosshairs of the DOJ for the last 2.5 years, because they started investigating me. I received my first call from them in July of 21. Wow. I did an interview in October of 21. My attorney received an email from the assistant U.S. attorney who has my case in November of 21 saying that I was going to be charged, quote unquote, within the week. And that was 23 months ago. I still haven't been charged.
It's so crazy. And the part about you, because you're not the only journalist that I know, you were doing your job. I mean, you had already established yourself as somebody that does independent journalism. It was a huge story, and you were there and you were in the middle of it, and nobody expected it. And I have to say, I do know a lot of people that went that day, and I'm saying like more than one or two that are not Trump supporters, or right. that's not why they were there. Either they were journalists or they were bunch of the people that I know are identify as libertarians that did feel, mm-hmm. it feels like the whole election system, not that it was stolen in this right. year, that it's been stolen for many years, that the people right. have not had a vote, that it's been a selection. And this seemed the most obvious. So they were going there to express their own feeling that our election right. system's rigged and it's broken and it had nothing to do with Trump. But what happened with you is that they, it seems that you were there and you witnessed a lot of stuff, but they haven't charged you to date. Now, when right. you look back at what you saw that day as a journalist, I think maybe it's because, but you know, we don't know, that date, did you see what you thought was a insurrection, or did you see a crowd that got out of control? I mean, what now looking back, thinking of what you thought when you were watching mm-hmm. it in real time, what were you thinking in your head was going on? Did you think that it was a clash, or it was a staged coup, or whatever they call it?
My opinions about the event have changed and evolved over the last 2.5 years. I know what I saw that day. Then I know what I saw when I started analyzing frame by frame my own camera in the days following. And then I began to gather a much broader perspective as I began to look at other people's cameras. And it's probably best to explain to your listeners and viewers this way. Your brain cannot handle an event like that with what it takes in through your own eyes. It just can't, unless you're an experienced combat veteran or combat reporter or somebody who chases riots for a living and is accustomed to that. This was my first time to be involved in a riot. I'm not a riot chaser. So there were two things going on in my mind at the time. One was capture what was going on as best I could as an inexperienced photojournalist, because that's right. not what I am. I'm a writer. Right. And then the second thing is to stay safe. in that environment. Get as close as you can and stay safe. I mean, I got hit by one of the flashbangs. It landed about 3 feet from my right leg, exploded, shrapnel hit me, and I had a bruise to show for it for 6 months. I can't imagine people that were actually hit, you know, directly with some of those things. But the point being is that after I had seen what I saw with my eyes and knowing that your brain cannot process that, plus all that's going around you that you can't possibly take in, then I started seeing more in my camera, from my camera, from my own videos. And then I started adding to that what was coming in from other angles. And you start developing theories, better theories than knee-jerk reactions. And even a couple of the early articles that I've written, I've not gone back in and edited them. I've allowed them to stand as they were on that day, but I have put a, you know, an editor's note and said, hey, there are, although I'm not changing what my analysis was at the time,
right,
I do see some of these specific events differently. Now, I'll get to the broader question that you asked. What did I see overall? First thing I always say, I saw bad people doing bad things, good people doing good things, and otherwise good people doing really stupid things. And then when you start looking closer, you start seeing people that you really don't know what they were doing and why were they doing certain things. And you know, the obvious things you can start with are the guys like Ray Epps. So you can start with, I forwarded once again this morning, and I've posted this many times because it's in the top 10 of my unanswered questions, is the gentleman who was there videoed with a gun on his hip.
Right.
He was on the FBI's most wanted list. And then suddenly they took him off. A year later, he was ambushed by some independent journalists in a parking lot in Arizona.
Right.
You've seen that one. And so Luke Robinson is his name. And for some reason, obviously, with photographic evidence of him having a gun, he's never been arrested. Now, we have to also understand that anytime there's a giant crowd, you know, a substantial crowd of any size, there's going to be undercover law enforcement there. There's going to be local law enforcement, and we know that there were local law enforcement there undercover. We know that there's going to be federal agents undercover there as well. That's not necessarily a nefarious or a bad thing. There is a, you know, as a libertarian, I do see a moral and just function of government, and that is to protect us from force and fraud. Right. And that we have people that do want to harm us, and in big crowds, bad things can happen. We know that. So that's not in and of itself a bad thing. But there are big questions about certain events and individuals and certain things that did happen in that crowd that day, outside, inside. And so I've spent a lot of my early time working on those questions. But then when the trials really heated up and we got into the marquee trials like the Oak Keepers trial, right, that's when I got more on the inside with specific cases related to the defendants. And that ultimately has led me to where I am today.
Yeah. Now you, were you let into the Capitol? Did you feel like you weren't allowed to go in there, or did you feel like you were, because the people that I know, that I know a handful that did go inside, two of them are journalists as well, mm-hmm. That they didn't feel like they couldn't, they felt like it was that they were just following the crowd and nobody was stopping them. Did you have that feeling?
Well, by the time I joined the line, there were already probably several hundred people already inside the Capitol.
Right.
I didn't see the breach. I was down below on the terrace filming that when the breach actually happened at 2:12, 2:13, something right, like that. So I never witnessed that. I did ultimately go through the same door, what they call that Senate wing door on the west side. And I did go through that. I followed quite a large crowd in through that when it happened. It was a situation where there were police lined up on the side. I have them in my video. They're standing around talking on, you know, they're
right,
some of them there are texting on their cell phones. Some
right,
of them are calling, you know, they're probably calling their wives saying, I'm okay.
Right.
Whatever the case may be. But what I learned later is that minutes prior to that breach, there had actually been what I originally thought, but what I saw with my own eyes, I thought it was a stand down order. It was actually a pullback order that had been given over the United States Capitol Police radio comms. And as that was taking place, it facilitated what ultimately ended up being a violent, and it was a violent breach. Let's just call it what it is. Capitol Police did not open that door. Their windows were smashed. People went through the window, they kicked the door open from the inside, and then the crowd started coming in. And then those initial provocateurs, those initial violent perpetrators, they spread out through the Capitol and started unlocking and opening all those doors from the inside.
Oh, wow.
There is one piece of information, and this is one of those conspiracy theories or one of those pieces of disinformation coming from people on our side.
Okay.
That needs to be dispelled. And I'm going to dispel it right now. I think that there was a total of 7 doors that were breached in the Capitol that day. The police never opened one of the exterior doors. Every one of those were breached by rioters who had broken through the Northwest doors or others and had then moved through the building and started releasing those locks from the inside. Now, after that had happened, and the crowd was overwhelming the cops, there are, in fact, videos of cops holding doors open. There are cops on the inside opening interior doors, kind of in a, okay, we're not going to beat this. You know, this is overwhelming. We're outnumbered. And so in a de-escalation kind of mode, they did open some doors on the inside. But there was not a single exterior door that was unlocked by a cop or opened by a cop to the protesters on the outside.
I think this is really important. It's funny, I had on Bill Shipley, as I told you before, and he also made something clear that has been out there that's disinformation that isn't helpful, which is that some of the people being held haven't been charged. He said, no, everyone's been charged. You know, some people have records you don't know about. There's reasons for all of that. And so, like, I think it's important now because I'm way past the point. I think it's uniparty. I think DC is a cesspool. There are no sides. If people are still picking sides and playing that game, that's their choice. I think it's a fraud. I think we really just have to get the facts out and be honest about everything. And I mean everything. And so to me, this is really important. People have to understand that is a storyline, that the cops held the doors open. The cops opened the doors. It's important for people to get the facts here. And that's why you've been so instrumental in this, because another place that you're also one of the only people, I believe, that saw the footage that they say that is being held back. What Bill was saying to me was that, yeah, there's 41,000 hours of footage, but he said that the entire thing was about 6 hours. And he said that before this part and after this time, that there's really not much there. You actually saw what is there. And one thing that before we get into what you did break recently, which will, I believe, be very helpful to some people, we watched the production. You've been in production and music and live venues for decades. Which was the January 6th committee hearings. I think that this was a total insult to everyone's intelligence, but people didn't get it. It was a Hollywood production. It was a show. A lot of the evidence that they claim they have has never been seen by anyone, was destroyed, it appears. What were your thoughts then as somebody that then watched this Nancy Pelosi and this group of people take this to the next level and actually put together a whole show to tell a narrative, a story that, you know, really at the time was so exaggerated. But from your point of view, when you saw that and then saw them put on this show, what were your thoughts?
Well, the first thing everyone should know is when you said it was a Hollywood production, that's not a hyperbolic description. That's not a metaphor. It's not an analogy. It is exactly what it was. It was produced by Hollywood producers for primetime television viewing. And I had, unfortunately, the privilege, I should say, to cover the Oath Keepers trial as these things were being released in real time, at the same time that the judge is instructing the jury, now, hey, you can't go home and watch that.
Oh my God.
I was appalled. I was appalled that anybody would think that a DC jury, with this thing happening in their town and all the disruptions that happened in their life as a result of that, that they weren't going to go home and watch the January 6th hearing as it was happening. This was, and this was a, this was something that the defense attorneys brought up to the judge, but the judge says, oh, I'll tell the jury not to do that. He would spin around. Now, tonight there's going to be a show. You can't watch it.
Right.
Oh, well, okay. You tell me that, what am I going to watch?
Right. You know? Exactly. Of course.
Right. When my church youth group told me not to watch Monty Python's Life of Brian, what do you think I was doing the next weekend?
I was
at the theater watching Life of Brian. You know, that sort of thing. And so I was appalled that that was taking place at the time. And then, of course, as I had time and access, I began to watch all of those in their replay. And then I also, you know, attained transcripts and began to pore over those, not only the ones that were from the testimonies that were telified in the J6 Select Committee hearings, but also those that were off, you know, camera, those types of transcripts. And so I know a lot about it. And I can tell you that in fact, there was a lot of scripted, not correct narrative in those, not only what they were doing, but also in what they presented. Now, on the other hand, there's also a tremendous amount of valuable information in those transcripts as well. And one of the reasons why that they want to archive that in the National Archive for 50 years before it's released is because there is, in fact, some incredible testimony in that. Some of it we've gotten our hands on, some of it we haven't. I also know, working again with investigators, actual congressional investigators there in D.C., that there are between 80 and 100 boxes of transcripts that are being held by one of the committees right now. I won't say which one, that has not been archived by the National Archives, but they haven't released them yet for review. And we have petitioned for review, and I know that there have been FOIA requests for that. And maybe one day we'll get to dive into those 80-100 boxes worth of January 6th transcripts.
Yeah, but none of these defense attorneys got it in time to protect the innocent. And that's where the biggest problem comes in. Also, I think most people that watch me know that Nancy Pelosi's daughter, who's a documentary filmmaker in real life, not just January 6th, that they started shooting 2 days before her and her husband and their crew shot the straight through. There's actually a video of her saying that it wasn't an insurrection and, you know, that it, you know, whatever. Right. So, that's out there. So when, you know, when we're saying, so that's very... That's very suspicious stuff happening right there. Now, there were the two police officers that a lot of people told me that were there that day had seen them. They became somewhat heroes along with Byrd to the people that wanted to paint this as an insurrection, a violent insurrection that was Donald Trump's fault. These two police officers also, I believe, have book deals. They became star witnesses of the January 6th committee. And you recently did dig into their testimony and I believe their book transcripts. And this could make a difference for some of these guys that are now going into the appeals process. What did you find there? Because there have been whistleblowers for the Capitol Police and against the Capitol Police and all kinds of stuff. And it's been very confusing. But the guys I'm talking about, most people saw them on all kinds of talk shows and saying that they're victims. I think some of them are suing. And so what did you find there from that inside track?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the video access that I got, because that's kind of the lead up to this. First of all, I was there every single day for the first Oath Keepers trial, covering that trial. I was sitting in the media room with all of the legacy and mainstream media correspondents. They're all of their legal and court reporters. And I was sitting in the back of the room watching them as much as I was watching the trial. But that's another story that I'll get to one day. But the point being is that watching that trial, there were several incidences that I saw, communications that I witnessed between the government's prosecutors and the judge. I saw overt attempts to prevent evidence from coming into trial that could be considered at the very least, it would offset some of the prejudicial videos that they were showing in those trials to those jurors that had nothing to do with the Oath Keepers, but it could have been exculpatory if it had been allowed. And then I saw the song and dance between prosecutors and the judge trying to suppress certain documents. And that really got my radar going at that point, because I felt like that they were really, okay, if you're not going to allow an actual transcript of a testimony in their FBI interview to be part and entered into evidence before this individual testifies, you are hiding something. It's not complicated. You don't have to be left leaning, right leaning, libertarian. Right. You don't. If you're not going to allow a government transcript into evidence that has nothing to do with national security whatsoever, then you're hiding something. So I had to know. And I eventually got my hands on those documents. And then those documents ultimately led me to everything, doing everything that I could do to become one of those first five journalists allowed into that video room at the Capitol to see that video. And I pulled it off. It was, you know, it was just.
Well, that's the way it's going.
Sometimes you have to sneak in the, sometimes you have to sneak in the back door, but I got in. And so I was one of the first five in there before the Congress and at that time, Speaker McCarthy had established their media policies and guidelines for applying for access and that sort of thing. We were used as guinea pigs, to be quite frank. But during that time that I had, I knew what I was looking for. I had my clues. I had my notebooks of notes. I didn't have to go in and dig through randomly 41,000 hours worth of video. And like Shipley told you, there is 41,000 hours. That's 1,700 cameras times 24 hours of January 6th. It's referred to as 41,000 hours, but really, like he said, there's only about 6 hours-ish that are really, really important that day.
Right.
Maybe 8. But the point being is that I didn't even need to randomly sift through 1,700 cameras worth of data. I knew exactly what time and exactly where I was going and exactly who I was looking at. And then became the not to put too fine a point on it or to downplay this. It's a very, very tedious process.
I can't imagine.
Once you find your target and you start following it, there's so many dead spots in the Capitol where they go out of camera frame. You have to triangulate from other cameras and find where they went. Okay, now we got them again. And you follow them through there. You log the camera number. You log the times where you see them, where you lost them. And then you start putting the pieces of all those puzzles together. So that's where that started. Now, to your question, the two officers, that testified in the Oath Keepers trial. One of them was Officer Harry Dunn. He is, in fact, has been portrayed as the hero of that day.
Right.
He is the one of those officers who has been basically given carte blanche and allowed to do unlimited number of media interviews, whereas the rest of the Capitol Police Force have to get permission or they're under an NDA or a gag order. They can't talk about January 6th. And so this guy's been able to go out and talk almost since the very beginning, and then has continued to do so all the way up to and through Trump's indictment. He's being brought in by MSNBC, NPR, et cetera, et cetera, to do
interviews
his. I mean, he's a cop. He's not supposed to be providing his political analysis on the indictment of a president, but they bring him in anyway.
Right.
Then. So he's got a book deal. He's been given a presidential medal, a congressional medal, other accolades, awards. He's been patted on the back by every possible dignitary in Washington that he can, left, right, and otherwise. And he testified in the trial about a very specific event that happened on January 6th between the Oath Keepers and himself, where at approximately 2:44 p.m., there was an intersection between him and those Oath Keepers where he ran up the stairs from the lower crypt area up to next to the rotunda and a little area, which is variously called the Speaker's Lobby or the mini rotunda, small rotunda. And when he reached the top of those stairs, one of the Oath Keepers saw him and saw that he was distressed, looked over at him to inquire, "What's up, man? What's going on?" And Dunn says, "They're killing us down there," and with a lot of four-letter words. And he said, they're hauling us off by the dozens on stretchers. Now, that's what he told the Oath Keeper. Now, just so you know, one of the other things that could be easily and quickly dispelled is that there were zero officers carried out on stretchers that day.
Right. So I never heard that before.
Right. Well, Officer Dunn was already in a panicked, in an imaginative state of mind at that moment, highly distressed visibly, and carrying an automatic rifle. At that very moment, the Oath Keeper, Ken Harrelson, went out and got three other Oath Keepers to come back with him and stand a line and formed a line of protection between him and some of the more agitated protesters, both to de-escalate the protesters, keep them off of him, and to prevent what could have been a really, really bad situation if Dunn had lost it with that automatic weapon. So that's what happened. That's the reality of what happened that day. There are videos. There are cell phone camera videos, a couple of independent journalists that wandered by that capture various aspects of the scene, but it has been hidden from us up to this point, a definitive camera frame, because there was no, as far as we know, there was no Capitol closed-circuit television camera right on that particular location at the top of that stairs. There was a camera at the bottom of that stairwell, but not one at the top of that stairwell.
Wow.
And so we know that there were more videos taken because we see people with their cell phones taking videos of that. But the government, the FBI, if those videos are captured, and we have to assume that they are, have never been released to us. So now we have to figure out what really, really, really happened in that situation. Right. And so did the government. So what the government did is they took a very shaky story from this officer Dunn, because in those two FBI documents that I referred to earlier, those were both interviews of Harry Dunn. And in the first one, he told one version of his interaction with the Oath Keepers in a very positive light. And this was in May of 21. Well, in August of 21, the FBI brought him back in for a second interview, and he completely flipped that story around, turned it into a contentious interaction with them, almost near violent interaction with them. And then on top of that, created another event downstairs at another stairwell where he said it was kind of some people that looked like the Oath Keepers. And I misremembered and I misconstrued the two events. But it was the one that was downstairs that was positive. But with the real Oath Keepers, that was the bad interaction.
Wow.
Except that there are cameras down there. It never happened.
Oh, wow.
All right. So that's.
Two.
That's exactly the first three cameras I went to when I got to the Capitol, CCTV, camera, treasure trove. The first three cameras, knowing exactly the time that he was standing at those stairs, downstairs. We knew that because we have Metropolitan Police body cams of Harry Dunn, Officer Dunn, at that moment on those steps down in the lower level. So we knew exactly when he was there, and that's when I started reviewing forwards and backwards, and the event that he describes never took place.
Never happened.
So in the trial, the government needed somebody to clean up this shaky, you know, conflicting story from Officer Dunn, so they brought in a heavyweight. They brought in Nancy Pelosi's head of security, who then testified. His name is Special Agent. He's a Capitol Police officer, not an FBI officer, but he has a designation of Special Agent because he's on their dignitary protection detail. And he actually was in charge of Pelosi's security detail. And so they brought this guy in. He testified in the trial very simply that three or four times he wandered past the Harry Dunn Oath Keeper event. And that all three or four times that he passed that event on his way to rescue Pelosi's staffers, rather, out of her offices, that every single time he saw that interaction between Officer Dunn and the four Oath Keepers, that it was always a highly antagonistic situation. That's what he testified in the trial. Now, anybody can have any opinion about any action or interaction they see whatsoever. Right. And that's pretty hard to contradict, except there's a big problem with Lazarus's testimony. He was never there. We have him dead to rights. I called it 2 months ago when I started teasing this story. I told people that I had the kill shot. And in fact, Special Agent David Lazarus was not anywhere near this location, just off to the side of the Great Rotunda. He was half a mile, quarter mile away, whatever, in the tunnels underneath the Capitol, over on the Senate side.
Oh my
of
God.
The street, across the street. And we have him on camera there. and not where he said he was. And then we tracked him all the way back, because he did say that it, when he heard on the radio shots fired, which was the shot that killed Ashley Babbitt, that he then left. He said he made sure that the senators were well taken care of, that they were protected, and that there were other special agents there to take care of their security. And at that moment, he began heading back over to the House side of the Capitol. The problem was, is that it took him fully 12 minutes to get back there. And by the time he got back, the Oath Keepers and Dunn had long been gone.
Wow.
He never saw it. 100% perjury on the stand. And we have it. And although we've already written the written or published the written version of this story through Blaze Media, theblaze.com,
yep.
we will be coming out next week with the actual videos. We have them. We have the videos. They have been given to us by Congress. The only reason we couldn't release them concurrently with the story is at the same night that we were putting the final touches on the release of the print version, McCarthy lost his job. And the pause button was hit on everything at Congress. So we lost the ability to get the security, the final security approval of our, you know, of our edited story together. And now we're waiting for a new speaker before we can release the videos.
Oh, wow. God, everything connects to everything else. It's just such a, it's one thing after another. Hey guys, thank you for watching the show. I just want to remind you yet again that we really need to be very cautious of what is going on with the economy, both here and internationally. Most of us know that the BRICS nations are looking for a gold-backed currency to dethrone the dollar being the world reserve currency. They have an event coming up on August 22nd. The BRICS nations are all going. There are also 13 other nations that would like to join the BRICS nations. And this is not something to not pay attention to. We have to make sure that you protect your savings. And that is why I have chosen Beverly Hills Precious Metals. That is where I have gotten my gold and silver. I leave it in a depository. I know it's there. I've replaced it with my savings. I've put there to make sure that I weather the storm no matter what. Be it the central bank digital currency, the BRICS nations, the dollar goes into collapse, whatever may happen. I know 401k, IRA, backed by gold, as well as having my savings, at least an amount of my savings in gold, in the depository or sent to you at home, is the best way to make sure you maintain peace of mind and make sure that your savings and everything that you've earned is safe no matter what comes. We will get through this. All is not lost. America will return to greatness as it always has been. But between now and then, we have to be very smart and very cognizant of what's going on. So please go to Mel K Gold, or go to the MelKShow.com partners page and go to Beverly Hills Precious Metals, and my friend Andrew will take care of you. He's got a great team. Gold is the way to go right now, and I know that no matter what, I'm safe. So please do that for yourselves. We really care about you here. You're more like family and friends, and I hear from all of you a lot. So I just want to make sure that you guys are doing something proactive to be prepared. All will be well, but take care of yourself now. Being prepared is always a good thing. First of all, that's extraordinary. I actually went to undergrad for journalism. I would have been kicked at NYU. I would have been kicked out within a week of who I am now. 20 years. This is 20 years ago. But what you did, that's what real journalists should be doing, which is finding those dots. And then when you got access to the video, going in, that's heavy lifting. I don't think this new crop of journalists that have been educated in the 2000s or whenever, and that these 26, 27-year-old people writing for AP or ABC or NBC even would think to do what you did. So I just want to say that that's very refreshing to hear a journalist actually do the heavy lifting of putting dots together and then going to prove it with their own eyes. So that's amazing work right there. And I'm sure that there's more that could be done, but that's one, I think that's one example. I haven't seen many, honestly, Steve, of true journalism in this case. And I'm really grateful that you're doing that and showing people how it's done, that it's actually a job that requires effort. But now we are in such a weird state, sad state, whatever you want to call it, in this country. Everything's very inverted. Law and order, the Constitution, the agencies, now the FBI, all of this has been affected greatly, I think, by design. I'm curious what you think, by January 6th. What do you think this has done on the bigger scale to this country?
There's two things that are stark Let's start with a statement that Nancy Pelosi made on the first anniversary of January 6th, the week of the first anniversary, which was the first week of 2022. She launched a series of commemorative events in D.C. leading up to the big day, the first anniversary on January 6, 2022. And in the very first event that she had, it was she had a panel of historians. And she introduced them by saying the purpose of what we're doing tonight and in the events to follow is to, and this is an exact quote, you can look it up, the purpose is to establish and preserve the narrative of January 6th.
Oh, okay? Really?
And then she said that same phrase over and over that week several times. It's, like I said, you can Google the phrase, establish and preserve the narrative of January 6th, Nancy Pelosi, and you'll see it.
1984.
And so here's what this event accomplished. It, in fact, gave the left a narrative unlike anything that they had secured in, I would say, 100 years, at least 100 years, maybe further back. But the point being is that they have used that narrative not only to launch this salvo of investigations and subsequent indictments against the former president. They've used this to launch an entire wave of prosecutions, not just against the January 6th defendants,
right?
Most of whom are innocent of anything other than simple trespassing. They were not rioters. They were not insurrectionists. They weren't doing violence. They didn't attack anybody. They didn't break anything. They had a cell phone and they'd never been in the Capitol before. And all of a sudden, hundreds of people are going in and they're like, hey, look, honey, we can go in.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
They took a couple selfies and then their lives were destroyed after that.
Right.
So I'm not talking about that, but they have been able to leverage that which took place 2.5 years ago to not only convict innocent people for that simple crime, but also our alleged crime, but also then to unload on the school board meeting mom right. protesters, the Catholic organizations, right. other Christian groups, other conservative organizations. They've been able to infiltrate and use that as justification to use federal resources and federal intelligence agencies to infiltrate all manner of right-wing groups. Not talking about militias. I'm not talking about the scary right. people that wear tactical gear and right. show up at protests. I'm talking about diverting resources away from real crimes and putting those resources on normal, everyday, constitution-loving, patriotic Americans who don't necessarily see things the same way as the people sitting in the White House or that control the Senate or that control the DOJ, but they actually see the country as it was originally intended and founded. Right. And yep. that's who they're going after. So they're using the justification of January 6th and saying that that was the beginning of and that was the first time we saw the single most important and dire threat to our democracy, as they like to say,
right.
was that group of people. So we need to infiltrate all of their organizations. And instead of and in so doing, they ignore the child traffickers, yep. they ignore the child pornographers. And we have testimony from our, you know, FBI yep. whistleblowers about that.
Yeah,
they ignore what's coming through our borders right, right. now.
Yeah,
and they are genuinely the threat now because right. they have diverted those resources against people who love this country.
I know.
They've diverted against those who are coming in to destroy this country.
Yeah. And we also, these people, the FBI, what they're really supposed to be doing is looking at, there's organized crime rings of all different kinds, some from the cartel, some from other places. These massive, like where all these people show up and rob full like streets worth of stores. There's all mm-hmm. kinds of things. Also, they've mm-hmm. taken them off the beat of everything, fentanyl, everything else. So what I've heard yeah. Is going on in these field offices. And apparently they have 1,000 more people upcoming. And the problem is that this isn't serving the people of the United States in any way. And then, you know, I know it's hard for people. They say, well, you shouldn't. What about this? What about that? Well, we also what happened on with Brett Kavanaugh, his hearing. We also what happened. I was in New York City during the Black Lives Matter riots, and they were riots and they were protests and they were violent. You know, a lot of us saw on inauguration day of Trump. We've seen a lot of this before. So it's just and you've watched us on the front lines, too. I'm shocked by the lack of compassion or humanity that has been shown to these people that are largely what you said. They went there that day. Not all of them were Trump supporters or whatever. And they saw something and it wasn't being stopped for whatever reason. And they thought that it was okay. I know two people who got arrested. And I firmly believe that what she was telling me was that she had to go to the bathroom and they saw the door open and they went to find the bathroom. And then they came right out and they got, you know, one of them's in jail. So for me, I think that the most shocking part is the lack of humanity and that's been shown to these people on a grand scale.
Well, the first thing that you have to remember is that when, you brought it up, when the BLM riots were happening, the first thing that the left wanted us to do, they petitioned us to do this, they demanded that we do this, was understand the systemic problems that led to this reaction to George Floyd, that it was so pent up that they exploded, okay? And they demanded that we understand that. All right. And then reaching out to us for grace or understanding, then their legal departments, their state, local, federal, started releasing these people that had, even the ones who had been arrested, some for violent crimes, destruction of property, setting buildings and cars on fire, throwing Molotov cocktails into police cars, things of that nature. And then they began to release them from jail. And then they also forgot that we remember that on January 20th, 2017, when the riots broke out in DC on the eve of Trump's inauguration, that there were hundreds of arrests of violence and property destruction of all kind. And even those who were going to trial, a DC jury wouldn't convict them because they understood why they erupted. They could, a DC jury understood that. They had compassion for them. So there were hung juries, there were acquittals, not a single conviction. And so as a result, the Department of Justice dismissed all other cases rather than retrying, are figuring out another way, are doing a change of venue where they could get convictions. They dismissed all of them. So fast forward to January 6th, and we have people. Oh, we had some violent people. Right. I want to know who they were. I want to know who they were working for. I want to know what their resources were. I want to know why they were there. I want to know why they were lined up at the Capitol an hour before Trump, finished his speech.
Right.
I have lots of questions. And lots of questions about specific individuals who have not been identified or properly brought through the system. But all of those people who have been charged have been forced into that same DC jury pool. And what's happening in every single case, every single time they're getting convicted.
Right.
Except for a couple of rare things, but we have questions about those too. But rare examples. But the point being is that we're not getting the same grace. And in fact, they're vile. I mean, I've never been a Trump guy. And I showed up with my camera, my tripod, and my microphone. And I have people online every day that are saying things of the sort, like I need to spend the rest of my life in Guantanamo being waterboarded every day.
I know. Lack of humanity is so shocking to me. I see, you know, Julie Kelly, I know shares your work too. Her too. I was on a Spaces with her and Laura Logan and some other people. And, you know, there was an NBC reporter on there who like literally thinks every single person should be put in jail for life. I mean, he can't possibly have seen all the evidence and really think this. But it's shocking, the hatred I've had on probably, you know, 15 people that have gone through the system. Some are in jail, some are, you know, didn't go to jail, but just to tell their stories. good people, you know, whatever the case may be, if there was crimes committed, that's one thing. But you and I know that the vast majority of these people, that's not what happened. It's not over. But the craziest part to me and the saddest part is that they don't. And this goes all the way. This goes back to the Russia hoax collusion, DOJ people. I see Weissman commenting a lot. We now have Jack Smith involved. And a lot of these people were involved, were in the Obama White House as ethics czars, you know, and people that, you know, were supposedly covering corruption while Joe Biden's whole family and who knows who else in that whole crew were ripping off the world at our expense. But I really have to say, it's very sad to look at this and think that they don't care what they're doing to the country, because I don't see, I mean, at least half this nation right now feels that the FBI, the DOJ, the entire installed regime is against them. And it's not sustainable. It's a very scary time. So I'm sure this week, after all you've done, you saw the, and I dug into who owns Newsweek. It's a very shady situation over there, but I have to tell you, the interview article that came out in Newsweek this week, I believe it's not accidental timing, and came out to say that basically, like you said, January 6th gives them a right. Apparently, we have a white supremacist problem that nobody can really see, but is there, and that they have a new division in the FBI going into the 2024 election. Anti-government, and as a libertarian, this must make you laugh, anti-authority, domestic terror. And I'm sitting there like, well, in America, you're allowed to be skeptical of the government and you should question authority, but now this is a crime. And I believe that January 6th was set up to allow this to happen. What are your thoughts on that happening and that coming out so brazenly? And then the FBI kind of confirming that that's their plan between now and the 2024 election, if we get there.
Well, remember the single most famous rant by Hillary Clinton was when she, in a very shrill voice, was screaming, "We have a right to question our authorities. We have a right to question our leaders. We have a right to question our government." Well, okay, they have a right, but we don't have that right. Now, to answer your question specifically, that article in Newsweek was written by a guy, his last name is Arkin, and he is I'll just call it for what it is. He's a very experienced correspondent, war correspondent, award-winning, but he's also over the years shown himself to be a very faithful and loyal mouthpiece for when our Department of Defense and our intel services want to leak something to the public. So when he put this out and he says this is what they're saying, yeah. I mean, this I think you're absolutely correct. This was not a coincidental timing. And he was actually delivering a message from our Department of Justice, from the FBI, and from our other federal agencies to let us know what was coming our way.
Yeah. And if you follow, like I'm sure you do, but I do, Strzok and Weissman and other people that have been behind the scenes, Eisen, a long time, you can see that these are real statements from real people.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. So it's a very scary time. But the problem is that I believe that the majority is at least a good, because you're a libertarian. I have a lot of friends. I do a show with a bunch of libertarians too that weren't Trump people, but certainly right now are. And it's not that they're Trump people, but the people that they don't like and don't trust so hard. So I think, again, like I believe with the COVID rollout, which I'd love to have you back to get more into other stuff, but the COVID rollout, if you go back and look at these same guys that I believe are talking like this and are leaking this through Newsweek to harm us, they were involved in this Transition Integrity Project a year before the 2020 election. There was lots of ways that they were looking at how to make sure Trump didn't win by any means necessary. Obviously right now, I just think that they continue to overplay their hand to the point that everyone sees it. These aren't Kissinger and Brzezinski type strategists. These are people I believe that are very, maybe when they dumb down our kids, they dumb down their own, because I really do see this all for what it is. And you're a libertarian, so maybe you can answer this better. I believe that people that are apolitical, independent, and libertarian, and maybe left of center, are all seeing this too and starting to realize, okay, well, right now it's them, but how far does this go?
I think you're right for the most part, because even on my side of the political spectrum, and although I'm not a member of the Libertarian Party and never have been, I've never been a card carrying member. I've always been an independent, what they call a small L libertarian. Yeah. I don't like parties. I'm one of those Washingtonian students who, when he warned us against parties, that I took his farewell address to heart.
Yeah.
And I see the dangers in them, and I take that warning as good advice, and I think everyone should.
Yeah.
But my point being is that as a result of not being in the party, I can't speak to how everybody thinks there, but there was a major tidal wave shift in that, even in that independent party over the last year, where a more, because the people come to libertarianism from both the left and the right.
Right.
And you bring those values with you from whatever side you're coming on, so you have half of the party that they hate cops. The other half of the party are back the blue, then you have half of the libertarians are pro-life and half of the libertarians are pro-choice.
Right.
And they think that that's the way everybody in their own party should be. So the libertarians are an interesting mix of people. And it's interesting that they get along at all. but on this particular topic, particularly if we're talking about Trump, it is a situation where if their guy doesn't get in, and the Libertarian Party's guy is not going to get in,
right,
it's not going to happen. But maybe they're looking at somebody else. Maybe they're looking at JFK. Maybe they're looking at DeSantis or someone else. And if their guy doesn't get in, I think that they will throw their lot to Trump, because they see it as, at the very least, even though there's things about him they don't like, maybe 50%, maybe they don't like his morality, they don't like his bull in a China shop New Yorker, kind of a persona. And I know I'm not insulting you.
I am a bull in a China shop New Yorker, I take it well.
They don't like his spending. They don't like, there's so many things that you can hang on him and say that's, we don't like about him. But when they see what's coming from the other side now, which is a absolute total 100% neo-Marxist march through our institutions, taking them all over, establishing a stronghold at the top of every one of those institutions, they own the leadership and they own upper level management all the way down through all of those institutions. So when they see that, they may turn to Trump and go, okay, this is your chance, save us.
Yeah. And we'll see what happens, because I also think, and this is for me from people that I know that have been in trouble with the law in their lives, they are watching what they believe happened to them happen to him. A lot of people that have been through the justice system and felt railroaded, or that they were indicted and shouldn't have been, or that there were, shady prosecutors and bad judges. I just feel like this is not going well for them. And I feel like the truth about January 6th will come out. I personally believe that it was planned for this thing, but we can't say so for sure. But where we are now, I really do see a backlash coming. And I think you've been really instrumental, because you're giving us the first piece of actual evidence that things were not what they seem. In fact, that they were lied about. And there's other people that have, but it's different to say it. It's like during the COVID, there were a lot of people, especially during the vax, saying things happen. I had them on. I got kicked off of YouTube because I had on too many COVID up people. But I have to tell you, like, getting to the facts, the meat that you've gotten to is a start. I think it's a good start. But I really do think that we are in very strange times in America, and anything could happen. I lean way more towards where you do. And when I say that all the time about Washington, who warned us about not having parties because the parties would eventually be more important than the people. And that was George Washington. Right. I feel like we're going back in that direction. That's kind of what I feel. I feel people have just thrown up their hands, get it's a uniparty that's totally corrupt, that these people really don't have power. We have like some kind of oligarch billionaire class that's running stuff. So I am actually hopeful. I just think it's going to be a rocky road between the here and there, as we know on other fronts. So I want to let you go, but I do want you to come back to talk about some of the other stuff that's going on, because you have a very unique perspective. And I really do appreciate that you do not bend No matter who tries to make you, it's nice to see people, especially in this online crazy environment, that stick to their principles and what they believe and their integrity, no matter what. And that's why I'm a big fan of you. So if you could tell the audience how to follow you, where to find you, and to keep abreast of your work.
Yeah, I've pretty much got everything distilled down to one little handle now, and it's TPC, the number 4 USA, TPC 4 USA. So you can find my blog on Locals, and that's TPC4USA.com, or on Twitter, which is now X. It's at TPC 4USA, or on Facebook, it's TPC 4USA. So anywhere, just plug that in, and you'll find me.
Great. Well, we'll have all the links below and below the show and in the description. So for you, as you continued on this journey, because I have a feeling you're just getting started, whether you like it or not, after 30 years of doing this, how do you want to leave the audience? Because I think right now people are exhausted. They're being emotionally, psychologically attacked. Yeah. They don't even know it. Information is coming from all over. You're somebody who's pretty good at discerning what's real and what's not, because a lot isn't. So what do you have to say to the people? And then we'll have you back again. But right now is on your mind.
Well, the first thing I would say, in addition to following me on all those other social media sites, is obviously the series that we've launched in the last week is coming out through Blaze Media. So definitely keep an eye out for the next part there. Yeah. But I'm attacked every day, and it's frivolous attacks online. It's people that just don't believe. I mean, they just call me a liar. You know, it doesn't matter what I've seen, what I've found. I'm just a liar. And then, of course, there's the people that want me waterboarded in Guantanamo every day for the rest of my life. So we have those kind of vile reactions that are out there. And I would just say, you got to stand strong. And the first thing is always tell the truth.
Yeah.
Always tell the truth. And I like the way Jordan Peterson puts it. He says, always tell the truth, or at least don't lie. You know, because sometimes we give an opinion that the facts don't back up, but we don't know any better. So when that happens, be open-minded enough to find the truth and then go to where that is, rather than drawing a line in the sand, digging a bunker in, and then standing on your opinion or your misconception or your previous statements. It's okay to say you were wrong. And if you go back and look at, as I mentioned in the very beginning of your interview with me, I said I've changed a lot of my thoughts and opinions and perspectives on things about January 6th because I got better information.
Right.
But I've been digging for that information for 2.5 years now. So
yeah, I always say to that to people too. When I first started this, I was just like a kind of an out of work writer, because of COVID. And I was like, what am I going to do with myself? And kind of got into this. And in the beginning, you don't know what to believe. But as time goes on, as you know, more and more is given to you. Then you got to see the January 6th tapes. Well, that's a whole different level of information that most people don't have. So people should all be looking for more information to correct what they think. And I think you're right about something. I get attacked, obviously, unbelievably, to like the level of absurdity. And it's fine, because, as long as people see us being courageous and keeping going, no matter what, they too will feel that they can. And I think that's like one of the messages of Andrew Breitbart was, keep going no matter what, because you're telling another guy that might have an important piece of this puzzle that he can too keep going as well. And I think that's what you're doing for a lot of people, Steve, certainly for me. And honestly, I think it's real journalism, and it's really fully to hear the story of you going and finding the timestamps and going and finding the timestamps, no matter how long it took to look through the footage. That is what real journalists should do. And there's a whole breed of new online journalists that could learn a lot from watching you. So thank you so much, sir. And I look forward to having you back soon. And God bless you.
Thank you, Mel. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. I don't know about you, but I feel a lot better being prepared for whatever's coming. Every day I hear something new. Something's coming from the CDC. Something's coming from the FDA. Who's trying to take over our healthcare system? All this craziness. And what I know is that one man really changed my life, how I look at everything that's happening to me health-wise. And that was Dr. Zelenko. He was a good friend of mine, a good friend of the show. And he came up with the most amazing product. Z-Stack has been a game changer for us. We have not been sick since we've been on it. We take it regularly. If we feel like we're coming down with something, will double up. But he has all new products over at the website. God rest his soul. He did not leave us unprepared, and that is very important for you to prepare. So he's got Z Shield, he's got a kid Z Stack, which is awesome. He's got Z Flu, Z Detox, he's got all kinds of things. He always said to me, your immune system must be clean, resilient, and resistant. This matters the most. And what I can say on top of that is that he supported me. He supported free speech. He supported medical freedom. He supported personal liberty, and everything that I believe in, he believed in. He inspired me to be myself, to speak up, to speak out. And what matters is that you are feeling healthy, whole, clean, clear, focused, and that your immune system is protected from anything that comes our way. And Z-Stack is the best way to do that. Please stock up on Z-Stack. Go to themelkshow.com. Go to our partners page. Goes down to Z-Stack. That also supports the show. When you buy from our partners, these great people, especially Dr. Zelenko, who is dear to me, you are supporting the show and keeping us going. And I know that truth, freedom, and the First Amendment matter to you. They mattered to him. They mattered to me. So make sure you're always healthy. You're always out there. You're always standing up. Be brave. Courage is contagious. The narrative is falling apart, but as it does, there's so much of this fraudulent disinformation, misinformation, censorship coming from the globalists. And what we need to do is be focused on the facts, cut through everything, be discerning, and get it first and foremost out there to everyone. It is important that you know what is going on. Censorship is getting nuts. You guys know it. There's accounts all over the place that are fake, that are not me. I know you guys send me emails and I really appreciate it. And you report it, and it's on Telegram and Instagram and Twitter, and they're not me. So I'm super excited to announce We the People with Mel K. Be the first to join. It's a VIP community, just you and me behind a paywall, no trolls, no nothing. We get to know each other. I will give you the facts first. I break a lot of stories a long time before other people. We can talk about past, present, future, history, what we're doing now, solutions for going forward, what 2024 is going to look like. I'm going to do breaking news, do a lot of deep dives. I'm going to bring that information to you guys first in a live Q&A every week. So please click the link below and join me over there. We are going to create a community that is censorship proof. It's cancel proof. It's truth. It's transparency. It's on the road to God, country, justice, everything that we want in one place. This is the most incredible, amazing time to be alive. As hard as it seems and as difficult as the battle has been for you guys and definitely for me, all I know is that we all are part of the solution. We are all involved and invested, and you guys have the passion that I have. So let's join together on live Q&As once a week with me, Mel K, we the people of the United States, taking back this nation. This is so exciting, guys. I've been dying to do this, and we finally got the technology right. So please join me. Click the link below. Can't wait to get started.